Let the Great World Spin was written by Irishman Colin McCann and inspired by a Frenchman. On August 7, 1974, Philippe Petit did the impossible. After months of planning and preparation, he strung a tightrope between the two towers of the World Trade Center and walked across it. In fact, he made 8 crossings, spending some 45 minutes on the wire, 110 stories in the air above Manhattan. Petit later chronicled his grand adventure in a book called To Reach the Clouds. To the best of our knowledge, he interviewed Philippe Petit when his book came out. Here is a short excerpt from that conversation.
When people see me as a dot in the sky, a human reaction is to point and say, he is crazy. But if you would follow me backstage in my intense and sometimes months-long, years-long preparation of an event, you will see that I am the opposite of a madman. I'm really preparing everything. Sometimes I even study the weather. I have a special cable design. All that actually, to me, is my safety net, you see. And what I wanted was to marry those towers that were doomed to be separated forever. After doing the first crossing, which is, of course, the most important one, I was not in the feeling of crossing and, you know, yelling my victory cry and say, I did it. I'm so far from what you would call a stuntman or a daredevil. To me, what was interesting was to present some romantic promenade. And after this first crossing, somehow I felt like, maybe let's make another one in a different kind of walk, more beautiful maybe. And then after that second walk, I was drawn into a third one in which I stop and I kneel and I saluted the towers. And at some point, I even sit down and look down at the little ants looking at me. And at some point, I lay down on the wire. All those things my friends told me after, hey, Philippe, you stayed 45 minutes on the wire and you actually performed 8 crossings. But that was not planned. That was theater.
Philippe Petit made his remarkable promenade between the Twin Towers in 1974. Much of the action of Colin McCann's novel, Let the Great World Spin, takes place on and around the day of the walk. McCann read a passage from his book when he spoke with Steve Paulson.
Those who saw him hushed on Church Street, Liberty, Cortland, West Street, Fulton, Vesey, it was a silence that heard itself awful and beautiful. Some thought at first it must have been a trick of the light, something to do with the weather, an accident of shadow fall. Others figured it might be the perfect city joke. Stand around and point upwards until people gathered, tilted their heads, nodded, affirmed, until all were staring upwards at nothing at all, like waiting for the end of a Lenny Bruce gag. But the longer they watched, the surer they were. He stood at the very edge of the building, shaped dark against the grey of the morning, a window washer maybe, or a construction worker, or a jumper. Up there, at the height of 110 stories, utterly still, a dark toy against the cloudy sky. He could only be seen at certain angles, so that the watchers had to pause at street corners, find a gap between buildings or meander from the shadows to get a view unobstructed by cornice work, gargoyles, balustrades, roof edges. None of them had yet made sense of the line strung at his feet from one tower to the other. Rather, it was the man shape that held them there, their necks craned, torn between the promise of doom and the disappointment of the ordinary. It was the dilemma of the watchers. They didn't want to wait around for nothing at all, some idiot standing on the precipice of the towers, but they didn't want to miss the moment either, if he slipped or got arrested or dove, arms stretched.
Ah, that is wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Philippe Petit's tightrope walk between the Twin Towers is the through line of your book, the thing that brings many of the storylines together. Why did you want to build a novel around this remarkable stunt on top of the World Trade Center?
But there's a few answers to that question. Firstly, you know, it's one of those incidents that seems to take the oxygen out of the air. Like when you talk about it, people are sort of stunned. You know, a man walked a quarter of a mile in the sky and he survived, and he went back and forth 8 times between the World Trade Center towers. And so it was an act of beauty and a sort of outrageous act at the same time. And secondly, because for me, It was such a sort of glorious act of creation. And it stands in almost perfect balancing opposition to that act of sort of evil that happened on September 11, 2001.
Now, like many New Yorkers, you have a personal connection to 9/11. Your father-in-law was actually in the World Trade Center when the first plane hit, right?
Yeah. And I remember we had switched on the television, my wife and I, and she was dressing my son. And she turned around and that was her father's building that had just been hit. The first building to be hit, the second building to come down. And he got out with 90 seconds to spare. And he came up to our apartment, which was about 4 or 5 miles away. And he was covered in dust and soot and dirt, and because he'd sloshed through the water at the bottom of the building and came out into that sort of glaucoma storm of, you know, debris. My daughter ran up to him and jumped up into his arms. And then she ran away from him. And I asked her, "What's wrong, love?" And she said, "Poppy's burning, you know?" And I said, "No, he's not burning. It's just there's smoke on his clothes from the towers that came down." And she said, "Oh, no, Daddy, he's burning from the inside out." And that was one of those moments when I thought, out of the mouth of babes, that, you know, sometimes they can say the most extraordinary things. But I tell you what, with him, you know, there are times he still wakes up and he thinks about the fact that he got down the stairs and he still remembers the faces of all those young men and women who were traipsing up the stairs as he was coming down. And, you know, it's hard to confront those sort of memories, but maybe time gives us a little bit of space and maybe fiction and maybe poetry or maybe just the fact that we can talk about it sort of changes our relationship to these things.
Well, tell me about your novel and about the characters in your story and how they connect with each other.
Well, so I had the tightrope walker. Then I really wanted to write about an Irish character who was living in the United States. And for a couple of years, I've been thinking about these people who are in religious institutions who sort of put their lives on the line, good people. And there are plenty of them about who are involved in religious orders. So I created this character by the name of Corrigan, who's a monk, an Irish monk from a small Catholic order that doesn't draw attention to itself at all. And he goes and lives in the Bronx with the streetwalkers and the people who are living in the projects. And once I'd created that character, what happened was he started to introduce me to other people. And in particular, he introduced me to all the hookers. Can I say that?
He becomes very good friends with the hookers in the Bronx.
That's right. That's right. And then and then I start to think about them because, you know, their lives have all that sort of drama and value and beauty and despair and grief and all these things that are sort of mixed up together that go to make up the human element. And then I started to think about, you know, other people who might have been in the city on the day. And in certain ways, I tried to make a sort of anthem for the city or a song of New York so that it can literally be read just as a story about people on a particular day in New York in 1974. Or it can be read, you know, as a 9/11 allegory or a story about people and how our lives sort of collide into one another. Even the smallest things that happen to us have an import eventually. It's like that old thing, you know, the butterfly that flaps its wings in China eventually affects the storm that happens in Wisconsin or whatever. And, you know, life is full of all those little glancing moments and we don't always know their import for us.
Do you consider this novel, Let the Great World Spin, a political novel?
Yes, I do. It's a good question and it's a tough question, but I do. You know, some of the writers I admire, you know, I think about the likes of Dreiser and Steinbeck and DeLillo and, you know, writers like that who sort of had, well, they sort of stood up and said, you know, this is my idea. You know, Doctorow is another one too. E.L. Doctorow, they believe in the social novel. They don't necessarily say that, you know, a novel's going to change the world. That would be naive to think that a book can change the world. But I think a book can become a stay against certain types of despair and also a stay against certain types of political behavior as well. You know, John Gardner talks about moral fiction and whether, you know, and I'm not saying that all writers should be like that. You shouldn't necessarily have to have a point of view. And my readers are much cleverer than I am. So I just present a landscape into which they can walk in and they can make up their own mind about the politics of the book. I mean, I don't want to be, the last thing in the world I would want to be is a politician.
Now, you've said that you consider your novel to be a 9/11 novel, which comes with a lot of baggage, I have to say. Sure. You know, there's this sense that it's kind of too easy to tap into the grief associated with that. And a lot of other writers have already gone over this subject, both fiction and nonfiction writers. Did you worry about falling into traps dealing with such a loaded subject?
You always worry. I mean, you know, it's my own emotional response to working out 9/11. I'm not sure that I have anything particularly like spectacular to tell anybody that they don't already know or hasn't already been said. But I do think that people can sort of enter this sort of landscape and, you know, touch upon moments of joy and moments of grief that they wouldn't normally have done at any other time. And the thing is, as a writer, you feel like you just do kind of what you have to do. And I felt completely compelled to do this. And the other thing is, you know, it's never just one story. The stories have to be told over and over and over again in order for their truth to survive. I think about, you know, Jewish writers, for instance, and how they have dealt with the Holocaust. And they have said that, you know, it is important for us to keep on telling the story, you know, for generations and generations and generations, not only to have a fealty to the past, but it's also to make sure that the future will know about this stuff. So it doesn't bother me if there were like 500 million novels or poems or screenplays about 9/11. I think one might eventually come along that really makes sense of where we happen to be.
Now, you're dealing with really difficult and depressing material. I mean, of course, the backdrop is what happened on 9/11, but the story back in the 70s, you know, the stories of the hookers and the people who don't have much hope. But yet it seems that what you're really doing is you're trying to work through that to get to a place where there is healing, where there is optimism. And I guess I'm wondering how you get there when you see all the rest of it.
I'll put it to you like this. In a completely different book that I did about 12 years ago, after it first sort of moved to New York, I got to know the homeless people who live in the subway tunnels. And they all wanted to tell a story, but there was one absolute common denominator. And that was, no matter how mad they were, no matter how smacked out they were, no matter how bad their situation was, every single one of them would say to me, "When I get out of here." There is a constant human holdout for hope that is part of what is the engine that drives us. And so for me as a writer, I want to sort of get to the heart of that and say that it exists and also run the risk, quite frankly, of being mocked, you know, because people say, oh, it's cheesy, you know.
So are you an optimist yourself?
Yeah, I'm an optimist. And can I say I'm a realistic optimist? I mean, does that work? You know, so you look at the real world and yet you still sort of dare to believe that it could possibly make some sense, that even in the face of all the evidence, we are still capable of some beautiful things, some good things. And I think that happens every day in everybody's life. It's a matter of trying to look and to achieve it somehow.
One final question. This novel, Let the Great World Spin, won the National Book Award.
But can I say something about the National Book Award? Because, like, you know,
sure.
I was born in Ireland and I became an American citizen, so I have dual citizenship. Part of what I find quite wonderful and thrilling about America and where it happens to be right now is that it is prepared to accept the stories of others. And so you have writers like Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, who's from Nigeria and living in Maryland, and she gets the MacArthur Fellowship, as does Edvige Danticat, as does Alexander Heyman. All these people who were sort of born abroad are sort of embraced as American writers, and I find that to be an extraordinarily generous thing. So the literary scene seems to me to be very, very much open, but I also think the country is opening in all sorts of interesting ways. And, you know, I took a bicycle across the United States 24 years ago, and I found it to be like one of the friendliest places that you could possibly be in. But to get the National American Book Award for me and to be Irish at the same time and to be allowed to be both was a most enormous honour.
Colm McCann won the 2009 National Book Award for Fiction for his novel Let the Great World Spin. He spoke with Steve Paulson.